I've noticed a striking paradox, and I wonder if some of you have noticed it too. On one hand, we want to know the truth about ourselves. We want to know how we're doing. We want to know how others see us. We want to know the truth. And on the other hand, we don't want to know the truth. Have you encountered this contradiction? We both desire and resist awareness of the reality of who we are. And as my case in point for this morning, I have a little something here, a little prop. You recognize this? You know what this is? some of you don't know what this is. Well, for the uneducated, this is a scale. And, you know, you put it down here, and then you step on it, and it gives you a number. And I'm not going to tell you what the number is that it's giving right now. But on the one hand, we need instruments like that because it gives us information. It gives us truth that we need to know and sometimes we want to know. But, you know, when I use that particular machine, I have a few tricks that I use. Maybe you have some of your own. You know, I typically only get on it first thing in the morning after, you know, not eating for about 10 hours. I usually try to do it after I've gone to the bathroom. I hope this isn't too much information for you here. I try to wear as little as possible and certainly not shoes when I stand on the scale. I don't do it after a shower. Typically, maybe because I'm afraid I'm going to take on water. I'm not really sure, but I don't do it then. And I usually step on it a few times, you know, to see if the numbers agree. And if they don't agree, I always go with the lower of the two numbers. Some of you, it seems, have some of these tricks yourself. Why do I do that? Because I have a love-hate relationship with the truth. On the one hand, I want to know the truth, and I need to know the truth. And on the other hand, I don't want to know the truth. But we all need outside, objective sources of truth in our lives. And one of those places that we can find such truth is from our friends. We need friends. We need friends who will use another instrument here. Am I shining in your eyes here? We need a friend who will hold up the mirror for us, who will hold up the mirror so that we can see ourselves as we really are. We need friends who will do that for us, even when it's hard. Pastor John Ortberg says this. He says, every one of us needs a few people to tell us the truth about our hearts and souls. We all have weak spots and blind spots that we cannot navigate on our own. We need someone to remind us of our deepest aspirations and values and to warn us when we may be getting off track. We need someone to help us question our motives and examine our consciences. We need someone to perform spiritual surgery on us when our hearts get hard and our vision gets dim. We need a few truth tellers. John Wesley, founder of the Methodist Church back in the 18th century, called this watching over one another in love. And the scriptures agree that we need people like this in our lives who are willing to hold up the mirror, who are willing to tell us truths that we need to hear. Let me just give you a couple examples. So in Proverbs 27, we find these words, "Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses." Or from Psalm 141, "Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil for my head." And then Galatians 6, "Brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently." We need truth tellers in our lives. And of course, we all know that there are good ways and bad ways to be that truth teller. I imagine that all of us here at one time or another have been the recipient of someone who wanted to tell us the truth, and they were well-intentioned, but their attempt was poorly executed. And some of us may still have scars from those kind of encounters. So we're in this series called Friend Requests. And what I'm trying to do throughout this series is have us look at requests that we might make of our friends to have stronger and better relationships. And the request for the morning, if we were going to turn this whole idea into a request, then the request would be, please wound me well. I mean, we wound each other. We do. And it's possible to wound each other terribly and painfully and sometimes even pointlessly. Wound me well. If you have something hard that you have to say to me, if you have to be a truth teller in my life, then do it well. Let's talk this morning about what that looks like. I'm going to offer you some suggestions this morning. And as I do, I want to walk us into a Bible story that actually shows us a time when this was done well. And we want to learn some things as we consider it this morning. So I'm going to take you to the book of 2 Samuel. And I'd invite you to join me there if you would. 2 Samuel. We're ultimately going to read a few verses out of chapter 12, but it's very important before I do that, that we understand the context, that we understand, you know, what leads up to what we're going to read in chapter 12. So to do that, we back up to chapter 11, and let me walk you through the story a little bit. I'm not going to take time to read everything. It'd be a great thing for you to read later on your own, but let me just summarize for you. So at the beginning of chapter 11, we find these words in verse 1. It says, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, King David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. But David remained in Jerusalem. Now, that sounds kind of, you know, innocuous enough, but there's some key ideas in that one verse. It's the time when kings typically go to war. And so they go out and they send out their army and they go along. In this case, for whatever reason, and the writer doesn't tell us why, but for whatever reason, David stays home. What that should cue in your mind is David is at a place that he should not be at a time when he shouldn't be there. The story goes on, and some of you will remember this story. One evening, he sees a beautiful woman. Verse 3 tells us that David sent someone to find out about her. And so the man, his servant, said, she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now the servant apparently senses some danger, because his words are a bit of a warning. David, this woman, she's someone's wife. She's someone's daughter. She's not just an object of interest or desire for you. David doesn't heed the warning. Verse 4. He sends messengers to get her. So she came to him and he slept with her. Now, some people read this story and they kind of question Bathsheba's role in all of this. What was Bathsheba's role? And when we read that, we can be tempted to impose our modern views of women's roles on the text. Understand that in that day and in that culture, Bathsheba had no power. She had no say in what happened to her. The king sent for her, she came. And the text says nothing negative about her. She did not do anything wrong in this situation. By the language we use today, we would say that this was not consensual. Bathsheba was a victim of sexual abuse, and she was a victim of an abuse of power by her king. Story continues. She ends up pregnant. David tries in some pretty ham-handed ways to cover this whole thing up. Ultimately, it's not working, and so he goes to the lengths of having Bathsheba's husband Uriah killed. He arranges his death, and then David ends up marrying Bathsheba. Now, that's the kind of the summarized version of the story, but there's something about the story that I want you to notice, and if you go back through and read it later, you might pick up on this. You might note the number of times that the text says David sent. So he sent out the army. Then a little later, he sent out someone to find out about Bathsheba. And then he sent messengers to get her. And then he sent for her husband Uriah. And then he sent a message to the commander that would get Uriah killed. He keeps on sending. He keeps on, in essence, playing God in the life of all of these various people because he's the king. That's the setting. Now, read with me, if you would, chapter 12, verse 1. And it starts, "The Lord sent." David's done all this sending, and now the Lord sent. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, "There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, 'As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity.' Then Nathan said to David, 'You are the man.'" Let's put ourselves in Nathan's spot for just a moment. He's a prophet of God, and he's sent by God to confront David in this terrible sequence of things that he has done. Understand, at this point, David is deeply compromised by his sin. It's been at least 9 months since all of this unfolded, because the text tells us, the end of chapter 11, that Bathsheba gave birth to a son. So David has been covering this up, and he thinks he's been covering it up successfully, that nobody knows what's happened. And now God prompts Nathan to come and speak. How might David take that confrontation? He's already killed once to cover this whole thing up. Who's to say he won't do it again? If I'm Nathan, you know, I'm probably thinking, why me? You know, isn't there someone better? You know, isn't there someone who's maybe closer to David, closer to the situation that could do this? I mean, you know, God, you can arrange for anyone to bring this message. You can communicate in a dream, you know, choose another way. Why me? And yet Nathan goes, and it's clear as he does that he gives some thought to it before he comes. David thinks that he's gotten away with this, and so he is going to be resistant to the truth. And so Nathan must have asked himself, how do I get past David's defenses? How do I soften his heart? How do I speak to him in a way that he might actually hear what I have to say? So he comes up with this story that he believes, rightly so, will get David's sympathy and will appeal to his sense of justice. So he tells the story, and you know, I again put myself in that situation. I think there must have been for Nathan this loud and long silence after he tells the story. And I wonder if he felt his life hanging in the balance. How is David going to respond? Verse 13. Then David said, I have sinned against the Lord. Cue loud sigh of relief. He's heard. He's accepted the message. He's ready to repent and to turn back to God. And you can, again, you can continue with the story. We're not going to continue with it this morning. But I wonder, have you had Nathans in your life who had the courage to speak truth to you that you didn't want to hear, who had the courage to wound you well? Have you ever had to be somebody's Nathan, telling them something they didn't want to hear? Well, this morning I want to suggest to you a few ideas about how we do that and hopefully do it well. And my suggestions are going to be a little less about the mechanics of how you do it and more about some things that you might keep in mind if you find yourself acting as a Nathan. And here's where I'd start. If you're going to be a Nathan, hold the mirror up to yourself first. Hold the mirror up to yourself. Take a good look in it before you even think of going to talk to the other person. Or if you like better, get on the scale yourself first before you ask the other person to get on it. Maybe you are not the one to speak to the other person about this. I mean, if you find yourself in the thick of the very issue that you need to confront the other person about, then you may not be the one. If you know, you hold up the mirror and you find in yourself very self-serving motives for going to the other person. So it's less about them and what's good for them, and it's more about you. Maybe you are not the one to do it. Maybe you're not close enough to the person to have earned the trust, the relational capital with the person to be able to bring this truth to them. As part of that looking in the mirror, you may need to ask, is this issue worth even bringing up? Some people, you probably know a few of them, enjoy, it seems, pointing out the faults and failures of others. But sometimes it's best to do what the proverb says. Proverb 19:11, a person's wisdom yields patience. It is to one's glory to overlook an offense. Sometimes the best thing to do is to overlook it. Rather than bringing it up, sometimes the right thing to do is to overlook. Now, that begs the question, how do you know? I mean, when do you overlook and when do you bring it up? And I'm not going to settle that for you here this morning. Probably worth thinking about and talking about a little bit. But I will say, a good indication that you maybe should consider bringing it up with the other person is if you find yourself trying to avoid them because of the issue. If that's the case, then there might be something there that needs to be talked out. Kelly Needham, an author, says this. She says, doing this kind of thing, holding up the mirror to yourself first, makes us gentle surgeons when it comes to wounding others. We only wound when necessary, and we do so to cause the least amount of damage. When we have had to look at our own failures, we are more kind to others in theirs. Before you confront someone else, always hold the mirror up to yourself first. Here's a second suggestion for you. Stand for the other person, not against them. If you have to be a Nathan, stand for the other person, not against them. It is easy to approach a conversation and situation like this as a contest. You know, it's me against them. Who's going to win? And if that is your attitude going in, go back to step one. Hold up the mirror a little longer. If you're confronting the other person, do it because you want what is best for them. Because you have high hopes for them. Because you want to build them up. Come ready to dialogue, not just to bring a monologue, kind of drop a speech and run. Come ready to talk. Coming to the other person is not, vent at them so I can feel better time. It's a time to bring concrete ideas for change and improvement. It's a time to be clear with them about what it is that you're asking, what you would like to be different. And because you're trying to build them up, I hope this goes without saying, but because you're trying to build them up, no harshness, no bullying, no shaming. Nathan has a hard message. And he uses a lot of care and thoughtfulness in the way that he brings it to David. Such that it's obvious that he, and by extension God, who prompted Nathan to come, stands for David, not against him. Let that be your posture as you come to someone. Here's a third suggestion for you. As you think about this idea of wounding another person well, no love without truth. No truth without love. In Ephesians 4, Paul writes about speaking the truth in love. And it seems to me like those two are such an important pair. Like Watson and Holmes, Batman and Robin, Bert and Ernie, Woody and Buzz, truth and love should always be seen together. See, we are often guilty of extremes. Some of us can be truth people. I just tell it like it is. You take me or leave me, but I tell it like it is. And, if it offends you, I mean, that's your problem, not mine. You just need to get over it. Some of us are truth people, aren't we? Can I remind truth people that Christians should be the most affirming people in the world? That we should do everything we can to catch people doing good. And to literally encourage them. Encourage means literally to put courage into them. And yes, sometimes we have to tell hard truth. But if our default setting is to, blast other people with the truth at every opportunity, we just might be missing something. And then there's the other extreme. Some of us are love people. Although what I'm about to describe really isn't love, but we think it is. The love people, we're so polite. We want to protect the other person's feelings at all costs. We want to keep the peace. Confession, I'm probably more of a love person. That's not really love. Sometimes love people don't want to say what needs to be said. Sometimes you get the feeling that everything is okay with a love person. Nothing, nothing's wrong. Everything's good. Nothing to see here. Kelly Needham again says, "The love our world is selling is that of unconditional acceptance. A love that says, if you want to tie yourself to the train tracks, it's our job to cheer you on. It's a love as worthless as a doctor who never diagnoses or a teacher who never corrects. True love fights for the greatest good of another." Now, when we're extreme love people, What that often ends up creating is what one writer called pseudo-community. It's not real community, it's pseudo-community. It's kind of fake community where conversations are always safe, but superficial. Everyone always seems happy and smiling on the surface. But when you really bring truth and love together and do it well, at times that doesn't keep the peace. Sometimes that creates chaos. Nathan risked a little bit of chaos here, didn't he, in confronting David? I mean, once he let the cat out of the bag, who knew what was going to happen? Who knew how David would respond? Nathan certainly didn't. Fast forward, you know, about 1,000 years into the future, beyond this story of David and Nathan, you come to the days of the early church, and what you find is certainly not a perfect or idealized church at all. You find conflict and chaos. If you really read the stories of the early church, if you read the letters that Paul wrote to churches in the first century, I mean, in the book of Philippians, Paul actually calls out two women by name and says, "Could you please work out your problems, ladies?" That'd be an interesting way to address conflict, wouldn't it? And then there's Jesus. Jesus, who was willing to jump into chaos and even sometimes to create it. He was the perfection of truth and love brought together. Tough when he needed to be, and he often was toughest on the religious leaders of his day, who, in their attempt to follow all the rules, seemed to weigh people down and actually keep them from getting closer to God. At various times, Jesus called them children of the devil, blind guides, and whitewashed tombs. Not because he was insulting them, but because that's how they were behaving. And he was willing to tell them that truth. He was the embodiment of truth. But Jesus was also tender. Last week, we read a story in John chapter 8 that shows just how tender Jesus could be. Radiating compassion for people. If it is not loving, then it's really not the truth, really. And if it's not truthful, then it's really not loving. Pastor Scott Sauls gives some examples. He says, if your friend is caught in addiction, the loving thing to do is to insist they get help. If a loved one is prepared to leave their spouse, their faithful spouse, for someone else, the loving thing to do is to tell them you will not support that decision. If your boyfriend wants to take the relationship to the next level physically, the loving thing to do is to put some boundaries in place and maybe even end the relationship. If the boss wants your help to hide some incriminating information from shareholders or the judge, the loving thing to do is to refuse. If a child lashes out and demands that you buy them that toy, parents, loving thing to do is to say no. Love and truth, don't ever separate them. Don't ever aim for just one and not the other. Here's my last suggestion for you. Picture what the other person can be. When you're acting as a Nathan, picture what the other person can be. And Paul, in that letter to the Philippians where he called out the two squabbling ladies, also wrote these words in chapter 1, being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Even as Paul is about to address a conflict, he is confident that God is working and that work that he's doing, he will carry on to completion. When you are ready to have a hard talk with someone, know that God is working. Know that he continues to work. Know that maybe he will even use this conversation as part of his work in the life of that other person. And picture what they could be one day. Picture where they could get to one day. Imagine, if all you can see is the caterpillar, imagine the butterfly. If all you can see is the seed, you know, imagine the tree or even a forest of trees that it could one day be. God is continuing his work. Here's my last word for you this morning. How do you respond when a Nathan shows up to talk to you? Do you find fault with the messenger? You blame someone else? Do you return the critique? You know, well, that may be true of me, but you? Do you tell them what they want to hear so that you can end the conversation as soon as possible? My simple encouragement to you is when you're confronted, hear and heed. Hear and heed. Listen to what is said. Even the worst criticism might just have a nugget of truth that's worth listening to. Don't look in the mirror and then walk away and do nothing about the bedhead that you just saw. There are times in my life where I haven't liked what the scale said. But I've usually been glad when I listened to what it said. We need tools like a scale. We need prophetic friends like a Nathan to help us see what we would not otherwise see. And so my friend request to you today is let's wound each other well with love and truth for each other's good always, that we might be the kind of people and the kind of community that God called us to be. Pray with me if you would. Jesus, with everything that I say, Sunday after Sunday, with every call that I make to us as your followers, it's always easier to say than it is to do. And so we come to you as our friend, and we ask by your Spirit that you would help us to do these things. To pair love and truth together always as you do. That we would always look at ourselves first and maybe even harder than we look at the other person. That we would picture what they could be, not just what they are. And all this for their good and your glory above all. Amen.